Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for coming tonight. We appreciate you showing up for what we think is a pretty important topic in the bilateral relationship, and one that perhaps think tanks like ours don't always give enough attention, and that's the role of the media in the Australia-Indonesia relationship. I'm joined by two very distinguished journalists, one Australian, one Indonesian, but we'll bring in the other participants from today's media dialogue, which occurred earlier in the day, who are seated in the front row. As much as possible, we want this to be more interactive and discursive than some of our events usually are. On the right, my right, your left, I have Andini Effendi. Andini is currently a news anchor for Metro TV's daily primetime show Trending Topic and a weekly English news program, Indonesia Now. Ms. Effendi is also an international affairs correspondent. Her coverage experience includes the 2010 Thailand conflict, 2011 Libya war, the 2012 U.S. election, and reporting on Syrian refugees in Iraq. She holds a master's degree in global affairs from New York University, concentrating in peacemaking and peace building. Helen Brown is a multimedia journalist with 20 years' experience. Helen has just returned from a four-year posting in Indonesia for the ABC's Australia Network unit, documenting the country's political, social, and economic issues, and covering one of its toughest-fought elections in a decade. She's covered numerous regional conferences such as APEC, the WTO, ASEAN, watching as world leaders have descended on Southeast Asia. And she's also served on the board of the Jakarta Foreign Correspondents Club for 2 years. Now back in Australia, she still reports on the region while also dipping back into her interests in business and economics. I want to start off with a question that we talked about at the media dialogue today. And quoting former Indonesian President SBY in his address to the Australian Parliament in 2010, which he said, "The first challenge is to bring a change in each other's mindset. I was taken aback when I learned that in a recent Lowy Institute survey," this was in 2010, 54% of Australian respondents doubted that Indonesia would act responsibly in its international relations. "Indeed, the most persistent problem in our relations is the persistence of age-old stereotypes, misleading, simplistic mental caricatures that depict the other side in a bad light. Even in the age of cable television and internet, there are Australians who still see Indonesia as an authoritarian country, as a military dictatorship, as a hotbed of Islamic extremism, or even as an expansionist power. On the other hand, in Indonesia, there are people who remain afflicted with Australia-phobia, those who believe the notion of white Australia still persists, that Australia harbors ill intention toward Indonesia, and is either sympathetic to or supports separatist elements in our country." I'd agree with SBY that those are some of the main challenges. I just want to ask Andini and Helen, what do you think is the role of the media when faced with these enduring stereotypes, which obviously you have to speak to folks who hold those stereotypes, but still explaining and giving context on the other country's politics? Let's start with Andini.
I think what we're doing in Indonesia is basically telling as it is. Let me choose like an issue. Let's say the tapping issue. And we're telling that it's not only that the Australian, another government is tapping into of our government, but Australia in particular is tapping SBY's family. So it's somewhat getting into a personal level where maybe, oh, there is something wrong with SBY and his family. So the framing is more not into the Australian government tapping as the president of Indonesia, but more what is going on within the presidency, within his family, and that Australia wants to know more about it. So the way we frame it is not the Australia as an outsider, but the issue itself. You know, so and we tell it as it is. We don't see it as, oh, this is a breach of our sovereignty. Of course, there's a perspective of that later on in the coverage, but the initial framing is that there is something wrong and everyone wants to know about it, including the outsiders.
I think the stereotypes persist mainly from the Australian side because basically Indonesia is a very difficult country to report on. There is a lot of nuance. There is the, what do they say, 50 Shades of Grey was a book that came out. And in Indonesia, they say there's 99 shades of grey. And so Australia takes notice of Indonesia, particularly when it's a big bang issue, like terrorism, the asylum seeker, issue, bombings, minorities being hurt. But there's always a lot of nuance around these issues. And, you know, I think the challenge for a journalist who's been in the country is to explain that nuance, is to get the context right. And then, of course, you have the idea that then the audience is willing to listen to that and take it on board. So this is why I think some of the stereotypes persist, because it's the big story stuff, but there's always a lot more to it than what you see, especially in Indonesia.
I want to ask some of the folks in the front row who were participating in our media dialogue today. I don't know if we have microphones at the ready or if we need them for this room. But Michael Bachelard and Prodita Sabarini. Prodita, you work for an organization that intends to inject that nuance into the conversation. I mean, is that a challenging thing to do in the Indonesian context, to explain what's going on, or is that something that is perhaps easier than we're making out to be?
My work is as a Jakarta editor for The Conversation, so I commission stories from Indonesian academics to write for the Australian website of The Conversation. And I think I do feel that there is a challenge, because The Conversation wants an Indonesian perspective about Indonesia to explain to an Australian audience about what's happening in Indonesia. And I think that's a really great initiative, and that's great that Australia wants to know more about Indonesia and wants to hear from Indonesian about that. But there's also another problem, I guess. Sometimes the Indonesian academics actually want to reach the Indonesian audience, and they don't necessarily want to explain about Indonesia very generally to an Australian audience. And so I have to balance that, you know, like making sure that the Indonesian audience will also benefit from this, from the articles and the conversation, but also bringing it to a bigger context, like a global context.
And Dina, you spoke a little bit about today the challenge of getting Indonesians interested in Australia, that they feel like perhaps they don't need to know about Australia. Can you speak a little about that now?
Yeah, we always feel there's a distance between the two countries. If there's nothing related to Indonesia in Australia, then we don't feel the need to know more what is happening in Australia. And I think because we always perceive Australia as this first world country, so they have their own issue. Therefore, you know, I don't think we can relate to that. And but if anything comes within the relationship between the two countries, of course, it will become the main headlines in Indonesia. And it will become something like, the perception will be, this rich country is trying to dictate us what to do. And it's always been like that. And they always got what they want. And our government has always been very lenient, especially the previous government. So that is why we couldn't care less about what is going on with our neighbor, I guess. And we're trying to portray like other stories that might interest our audience, say for TV. The only interesting stories for TV audience was the death of the, what's the name of the guy? Crocodile Dundee? Steve Irwin. Yes, that guy. That was like the major story, that nothing related to Indonesia, and it will become like a headlines, and also like the top news of the day.
I think NT News needs to open a Jakarta bureau. Michael, you have thoughts on this?
Michael Bachelard, I'm a former Fairfax correspondent from Indonesia, just returned, and I found the stereotypes frustratingly difficult to shift. In fact, I spent 3 years trying to kind of, you know, give a more rounded view of Indonesia to an Australian audience, and yet, you know, I suspect when the next Lowy poll comes out, still 53% of people won't know, or whatever the figure is, won't know that Indonesia democracy, even though I spent a year writing about their recent election. They are very persistent stereotypes, and the stereotypes go both ways. You know, in Jakarta, it's still firmly believed by most people that Australia has a deep and abiding interest in separating Papua off into its own independent nation. So Prodita made a really interesting comment in the meeting earlier, which, since she didn't want to pass on, I will, which is that it, you know, it's probably less the role or even less possible for the media to educate and create a sort of an interest or a deep interest in Indonesia than it is for popular culture. And so in that respect, you know, South Korea has done an amazing job in its export of K-pop, which is huge in Indonesia, and is doing better at relations with Indonesia than we are. And to the extent that's true of Australia, that perhaps the most important relationship we have is not between Fairfax journalist and Indonesia, or Fairfax journalist and its counterparts, but with Junior MasterChef and its audience, which was huge when I was there in 2012. So, you know, perhaps we should be looking at more sort of soft culture rather than, you know, hard culture types of things to shift some of those stereotypes.
I think that's a good opportunity to bring in Lisa Siergar, who is the features editor at the Jakarta Globe and writes quite a bit about culture in Indonesia. I mean, does Australian culture connect with Indonesians, or have there been examples of that?
The MasterChef one, basically, but not so much, actually. We got a lot of invitations to cover stuff to Singapore, Hong Kong, Taiwan, basically all Asian countries, but not so much from Australia, so... Yeah, I just came back from Melbourne to cover the Indonesian Film Festival, and the people who organized the film festival said it was the first time for them to actually reach Indonesian media. It was like their 10-year anniversary. So after 10 years, they finally thought, oh, maybe we should, you know, go back to Jakarta and, you know, call the media and tell us about what we do here. So, yeah.
I want to just ask, we had a number of conversations about sort of shared challenges between the Australian with both Australian the press and the Indonesian press, particularly declining readership and perhaps declining influence of news organizations on both sides. I mean, how has this affected coverage for both of you? We talked about, you know, personal brands and media brands.
Well, I guess, you know, the ABC is not so much about branding as trying to explain a story and bring both sides of the story, and you know, that's what we're meant to do. But what I did notice when I was in Jakarta was first the huge growing interest internationally in Asia and other media outlets coming in and setting up more resources in the region. Secondly, that there are more media sources. I think Australia, as a market in terms of media consumption, is still perhaps a little bit behind what's happening elsewhere in the world, in that, you know, there are lots of ways to consume your media now, your news, your information, your entertainment. Mostly it's done through your smartphone, on an app. There are several different ways now of having your information collated for you and getting it via these different applications that, you know, will just start working out your preferences and send you the news articles from around the world. So it's becoming more diffuse. And, you know, we were talking about media influence. I always think that the influence of the media does count to some extent on how obviously receptive people are to the information that is already out there about a country, hence the K-pop phenomenon. You know, people start taking more interest in Korea and the Korean Traders Association, et cetera, et cetera. That's how it carries on. Now you have this added complexity if you're trying to talk about a country and explain a country, that there are a lot more outlets now for people to get their information from. It's diffuse. You know, I think I explained I had a story that ended up on an app somewhere, and they emailed me and said, congratulations, we've put your story on Issue. And I'm like, oh, what's Issue? Like, where has my story ended up? But, you know, this is the way it's going. So it's a very, very different environment, and Jakarta has a very vibrant media environment, as you know, and this is what's going on. There's a lot more competition for that space.
We talked about a potential new competitor to Metro TV being funded recently. So, I mean, is this a challenge for Metro?
I'm sure it will be a challenge, but now I think Indonesians in general, they still go to television as a source of information. Even though Indonesia has the largest population of Facebook and Twitter, but it's more like secondary source of information for them. So people still watch the news on TV, whether from Metro TV or from any other channels, you know, but they still see TV as their main source and get everything else as additional information from elsewhere. And I think what the industry, especially our TV industry in Indonesia, Metro has always been in the lowest ratings, as you know, but I think we're not ambitious enough, you know, we're not ambitious to be like, oh, we have to be the top five or whatever, because then again, it's a very idealistic objective to begin with. And we still figure out that maybe in 20 or 30 years, Indonesians are still pretty much are going to watch TV to look for the news, you know. And as we grow, as Helen said, we can also deliver news in our smartphones and the platforms of, let's say, social media. So even though there are like competitors now starts to growing in Indonesia, but it's not the biggest concern, I would say, especially for the senior TV stations.
I should add, you're very modest. Metro TV may have a smaller share than some of the other stations, but has a very strong following among people in government and the elite, which is perhaps why we have both an ABC correspondent and a Metro TV correspondent up on stage. You both speak to very similar audiences. I think Ross Tapsell, who works on these issues at the Australian National University, you had some very sort of cutting insights today. I thought bringing you into the conversation.
Yeah, thanks. I've been working on media and Australia-Indonesia relations for about 10 years now and I've just published a book on this. Looking back at all the government documents over decades, what the consistent theme on Australia-Indonesia relations documents is the biggest cause of bilateral relations disturbances between the two countries is the media. And you saw this from 70s, particularly since 75 and the Balibo case, and then from there onwards through the 80s and 90s, that it was the troublesome and meddling, in particular Australian media, that disturbed otherwise really positive relations between the two governments. And of course, you know, we talked about this, about how that can be a cop-out. And how it's an excuse for the government to say, well, otherwise everything's perfect if it wasn't for the troublesome media. And I think really when it comes to stereotypes, the big issue is education, and particularly primary and secondary school education. We've been saying for a while now, you know, Australia needs to move towards the Asian century. We had the Asian century white paper with a lot of fanfare that has now been archived. I went through my entire primary and secondary schooling without hearing the word Indonesia until it was, in fact, in year 12 when during the East Timor case. So we really only hear about, you know, we don't teach anything about Indonesia in schools, certainly when I went through school. And as I said today, if you were going to try and convince Indonesians that Indonesians should learn about Australia, frankly, I mean, it just wouldn't happen. You've got more chance of getting Indonesia in the Australian curriculum than you do getting Australia in the Indonesian curriculum. And that tells us something also about the relationship and a little bit about what you touched on about general disinterest in Indonesia.
I wonder if I might just open it up to discussion rather early. I think there are a number of folks with long experience in journalism in Indonesia in the audience. Are there questions in the audience? See Hamish McDonald back there, and I might just pick on you because I think you had something to say.
Well, I think the work of reporting Indonesia or finding out about Indonesia now is vastly more simpler and faster than it was in my day, which is now 30 years ago in Jakarta when we didn't have mobile phones and we took our copy down to the public telex office to send off or dictated it by phone. We could disappear for a week or two without being in contact with head office, but now everyone is wired and expected to file instantly on all kinds of media. I think that's encouraged a kind of laziness back in the head offices, that they don't need to invest and they can get it anyway when they want it. So it's a struggle for the remaining correspondents on the ground to get out and do anything in depth and initiate their own research. And obviously there are people like Michael Batchelard and the ABC's Jeff Thompson and others who've done long pieces in great depth, and I still remember them. But the other factor is that, as Ross was saying, it's a cop-out for the politicians to load it all onto the media and blame the media for the poor state of relations and to say, but for that, things would be fine. You know, there is a basic message, you know, whoever delivers it, and on either side, if you want to look, if you have a stereotype, you can find things to support that, you know, whether it's the continuing role of the military in the territorial function in Jakarta, in Australia, the fixation, obsession with boat people, the bugging of the presidential phones, the existence of a strong Papua lobby here. So you can find that. But what is lacking is the investment in the relationship, because politicians aren't prepared to stand up and say, yeah, all our primary school kids should be learning Indonesian, and they're not prepared to fund an initiative like that. So we're a bit, you know, we tend to be rather the whipping boy for failings of our governments. And it's got harder because, A, the news has become more trivialised, and, B, the sort of natural ballast that was there, like the Radio Australia audience of 20 million in Indonesia, has vanished. So there is, as Helen was saying, a need to get out and be more proactive, finding new ways of reaching people. But I think Ross was spot on saying it has to start in schools, certainly on our side.
I want to just ask Andini Effendi, because she's one of the few Indonesian journalists who is regularly reported from overseas. And we talked about today, there is no Indonesian correspondent in Canberra, right? There's no one who's permanently based there. I mean, is this, as Indonesia's role in the world presumably grows, as Indonesians begin to feel like their weight should matter more in world affairs, do you see a chance that Indonesians will go out and cover the world and say, the way that Australians do with quite a few reporters in Jakarta?
I think so, yeah. I think there's a huge possibility that Indonesian media outlets will send someone as a permanent correspondent now. I think the issue for us, TV mainly, is because A, budget is always an issue, B, whether there's a heavy connection with Indonesia, and C, we can always use, like, freelancers, say Indonesian students in Canberra or in Melbourne and Sydney. We're always doing it, you know, and we have like some sort of a permanent freelancer working for us, though, from those three cities. So, but in the long run, I think it is in our agenda to have someone here, as the relationship is getting somewhat complicated yet interesting, and there's a need to have focus on Australian-Indonesian relationship.
I see a question way in the back there. Do we have a microphone?
Geraldine Duke from the ABC. Look, I actually wrote a piece for the for Sam Roggeveen for the interpreter about 2 or 3 years ago, about approaching reporting as shared dilemmas, rather than as, you know, I mean, breaking in a way some of the rules about crisis-led reporting, worry-led reporting. And I got quite good feedback, you know, from people who read The Lowy Interpreter, but I don't think it went much further than that. But I must say, I sort of despair about, and I don't know, Helen and Andini might wish to say, like, there's so many stories that there's no curiosity about. And I don't know, honestly, whether that initiates from the correspondents on the ground or whether it's the editors. You know, I've been fascinated because I sat beside an Indonesian renal surgeon on the way to a big conference about the terrifying rates rise in diabetes. and in kidney problems because of the massive change in food habits, the massive change in exercise habits or the lack of exercise habits, the worries about families, the ways in which families are working. All of these things that are critically important here in Australia too, and we worry about, that's what I want to hear much more of. I want to hear what's happening to the middle classes, not the super rich or the village. I want to hear what's happening to the middle classes in Indonesia, and I never do. And I don't know why I don't.
I hate to make you liable for answering that question.
Hi, Geraldine. Michael Batchelard. Nice to meet you. if I'd sat next to a renal surgeon and I'd heard that story, I would have been on the story in a flash. I didn't hear that story. I tried to do as many stories as I could about Indonesia for Australia and tried to find ways to interest my editor in that, and I'm sure Hamish will recognise the impulse to attempt to shoehorn as much as you possibly can into the kind of sometimes unfriendly environment of an Australian media outlet, to find the one sort of speck in that story that will interest your audience in Australia. I didn't do the health story, but I would have loved to have done it. I wasn't aware of it, to be honest. I will suggest it to my successor. Yeah, it's very interesting, and it is. It's about the growing middle class and so on. You are the one person. Certainly, I think ABC had two people. The other outlets have one person there who's got to cover Chappelle Corby and the Bali Nine and the boats and a bunch of spying or whatever comes up. And, when the spying story hits, that's your week gone. You might have had a plan to go to Papua that week, but your week's gone because that's for the spying story. So, it's a fantastic job. It's the best job in the world. And it's also, as Helen was saying, it's across Twitter and Facebook and 24-hour filing and, you're crossing five or six times a day to radio stations who don't have their own correspondence, so they borrow Fairfax's. So it's a massive thing. But you're right, we should be hearing those kinds of other stories, and the correspondents, I believe, have a responsibility to try and do them as well.
I know, Helen, you wanted to get in here as well.
Oh, yes, because I was very fortunate. My brief was to talk about Indonesia, what is interesting about Indonesia, not just what interests Australians about Indonesia. So I had a lot more scope, which was fantastic. And we did do stories about the middle class. I think that's a good one. I had heard the diabetes thing is a real worry in Indonesia. We did one on young people who are earning more money than usual and had never been given financial advice before. So they were trying to save up for a home and have children, and they knew nothing about saving money or having a mortgage. So we explored that with an Indonesian woman who was providing planning advice and a young couple, who are trying to save up so they didn't have to live with the parents anymore. And those are the stories that are really interesting about that country, I agree. But I'm not sure what the audience is for them, who's listening, who cares about them. It was sort of hard to gauge that from where I was. But there are a lot of similarities in that way that we could definitely explore more that aren't known about Indonesia.
I wonder if we could just continue along this theme. And I know one of the Australian journalists today said it was difficult sometimes to speak to an editor about reporting an Aboriginal story. And the Indonesians said in response, sometimes it's very difficult for us to get stories reported about religious minorities. But Nivel Raida, the news editor at the Jakarta Globe, has actually reported some of those stories. So I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about some of those challenges.
One of the challenges is probably reporting on religious minorities, that people's perception about religious minority, they can be, really, really damaging, because it has to do with, years of indoctrination. Just to try to prove to them that, actually they're just people like you and me with everyday problem who requires respect and to be treated equally. And yes, some of that narratives is just really hard to report in Indonesia. I remember one time I was about to do a story on Ahmadiyya, which is a religious minority sect, which is the most persecuted group in Indonesia. And the driver was like, when he found out that I was going to an Ahmadiyya village, he was just like really, really scared. I mean, his face is just like changing. And he wouldn't go inside. He would just like wait a couple of hundred meters from the house that I was supposed to interview. So those are some of the challenges, and in Indonesia, sometimes reporters can be as lazy as, you know, whatever your government official says or whatever your cleric says, and you accept that as a fact, and they don't bother to cross-check, verify, especially when you're dealing with something which is accepted, the accepted truth. You know, in the
talking about, do you see that changing over time? Has that been changing, say, in your time at the Globe, as you've been covering these issues?
Certainly for me. Like before, I didn't know anything about Ahmadiyya, but then I went on, and then. I think there hasn't been any attempt, real attempt, to just dig more into. I think we need something which is kind of like the act of killing, for example, who can just like destroy a lot of the myth surrounding this religious minority. We need to have more books on Ahmadiyya or religious persecution, or just like have more discussion. And I was speaking to an activist who had this project of, you know, supporting pluralism, tolerance, and stuff like that. It's easier to get an Ahmadiyya person and a Christian talking and then sharing their issue rather than an Ahmadiyya and a Muslim and a Sunni, for example, or a Sunni with a Shiite, which is basically they're both Muslims. To agree or something, or to see eye, or to treat each other with the same mutual respect, or to treat each other with as people, as humans.
I want to explore more journalism's role in that, but I thought I'd just go back to the floor because I saw there was some interesting right there in the center.
Just a non-professional question about the stereotype of the Australian. Did Lowie run the survey about Australians visiting Bali? Is it possible that the media could provide a bridge between all the Australians that visit Bali and educate them that this is really Indonesia? And what's the difference between Bali and the rest of Indonesia?
I think our polling director in the back, Alex Oliver, was the one who directed that poll with the question about Bali. Where are the numbers actually?
It was the Lowy Institute poll in 2010. We have a tool called a thermometer, and every year we ask Australians their feelings towards other countries, and we ask them to rate the feelings on a scale of 0 to 100, where 100 is very warm and 0 is very cold. And Indonesia has always hovered somewhere around that murky middle, around the sort of high 40s or low 50s, so not warm, not cold, really quite ambivalent. We thought it'd be interesting one year to ask the same question about Bali as well as asking about Indonesia, and interestingly there were different responses. The poll I think that the gentleman's referring to was actually done by a news poll, I think it was a couple of years ago, under contract to the Department of Foreign Affairs, and there was a large proportion of Australians, I think it was around 30%, who weren't aware that Bali was part of Indonesia. So there is an issue with Australians' lack of awareness, one could say ignorance, about, you know, largest near neighbour. And that's one that I guess could be addressed by the education that Ross was talking about.
Indonesians in the audience will be interested to know that when you buy electricity adapters in some stores in Australia, they say that they're compatible with Australia, New Zealand, the United States, and Bali, which is unfortunate. Tom Switzer. Yeah.
Media treatment of the death penalty issue in the last 2 months soured public attitudes towards Australia.
Well, we just talk about it the whole day, actually. We actually have a stance about the death penalty in general that we're not supporting it. But
Metro TV, when you say
TV. Yes, Metro TV. I think Indonesian media in general, especially TV, they're not supporting it. But then remember the Australian aid issue came out, and it's sort of like the relationship between the two countries was getting sour, and people were kind of like, let's just get it over with. Let's just execute it and just be done with it, because, you know, they're not respecting us. Yes, it is wrong what they did, and we don't support capital punishment, but then again, you sort of like hitting the below the belt with the tsunami aid. So, and then there's also a perception where, oh, I think the Australian government has asked many times the Indonesian government to do so many things, including turning back policy and then the spying issue. So this is something that the president and the media wants to portray, and even the public, Indonesian public, they want to send a message that I think this time you need to obey us, and this time we have the control over the issue, and that is what is happening sadly at the moment.
Tom, did you want to follow up on that?
There's a widespread consensus, I think, among the media elite in this country and even the populist media that the Australian government, supported by the opposition, has a right to tell the Indonesians to change their position on the death penalty, with or without the prospect of aid coercion. To what extent, I mean, you know, the Indonesians obviously are very proud, sensitive people. They have long memories of colonialism. To what extent does this perhaps touch a raw nerve in the Indonesian psyche that a Western power is sort of seen as lecturing and hectoring the Indonesians about what is essentially an internal matter?
I think it's up to extent where... This is how we see it. I mean, this is what I personally see it, though. The only country who has been sending out a strong message to Indonesia in the death penalty rows was only Australia, not Brazil. Brazil is, yes, they sent a subtle message, but it's not as strong as Australia, and not even French or the Netherlands. But I think because of the relationship is not in a good terms even before the execution, it's sort of like giving it very difficult times, even for the Indonesian media to be supportive of the Bali Nine duo. I mean, for us, Metro TV, we want to come to the prison and interview the Sukumara and Chan, but there's somewhat like my editor was kind of like very... not very keen on doing that, because the perception of us in Australian eyes is not good anyway. So why would we do it? You know, why would we help them? So that's up to that extent, I believe.
Is some of that related to the coverage of and the Australian government pressure in the Schipkel Corby case?
Yeah.
Was that part of the factor in pushing the relationship in that direction, or was it the spying? If you could put your finger on one thing.
Many times, though. I cannot pinpoint one case, because it happens like in numerous ways, you know, and it happened in a very like short time after Schipkel Corby, and there's a tapping issue, and then there's the Bali Nine, and then I forgot the turning back boat policy. So many issues that has hampered the relationship itself. So,
and my sense was that the Coins for Abbott campaign took off. In fact, it took off much quicker than we expected. I was still writing about the Brazilian snub to the Indonesian ambassador designate, and this Coins for Abbott thing started picking up speed. And it was explained to me, one of the explanations to me was that, you know, this was a chance for ordinary Indonesians to show how they felt. That was their opportunity to take part in something. The sort of that accumulation of ill feeling, I guess, in a way, and they felt insulted, but this was a physical thing that they could do to show that, and that's why it gained so much traction. And, you know, in some places it was a joke. People would give you a coin and say, here you go. There was that understanding it was on that level. But there was also, you know, a lot of people were taking it very seriously. And I think it surprised everyone as to how much it took hold.
Actually, ask a question, Andini. The question, to follow up on what Tom was asking, does the media pressure have this effect? I want to ask you to draw a distinction between the Australian media and what it says and the Australian government and what it says. Has it been the government's comments or the media's comments that have offended Indonesians?
I think it will be both. I told you earlier about the media coverage, what we did in Cilacap, where the execution is going to happen. We're trying to portray whether Australian media really present there. Right, and then what we saw is only two Australian journalists, while the scrutiny, the hype in Australian media about the execution was really huge at that time. But what we see on the record was, what, there are only two Australian journalists covering this massive story? Well, we hear so many negative things about Indonesia and how we will proceed with the execution. So it's somewhat both ways now, not only the Australian government, but also the media.
I think it's interesting that you said Australia was the one that was making the most noise about the executions, not Brazil, and yet it was Brazil that refused the new Indonesian ambassador. It was Brazil that withdrew their ambassador twice, and yet the Australian government has done none of that, but the Australian media was very vocal. So it's interesting. It seems that the media coverage resonated more than government's actions in that particular case. Is that fair to say?
Well, what happened with Brazil, we did put a lot of focus on that as well. But then again, we don't have any strong relationship, I guess, with Brazil, right? There was only that one issue that relates to both countries. Meanwhile, in Australia, there's so many issues, like I have mentioned earlier. So the perception, the acceptance of Indonesian public is more towards Australia, of course, and it's more diplomatic. It's more like G2G, the kind of issue, not with people to people, right?
Sure. Pradita.
Comments about the aid, the tsunami aid, was a point where it just made the Indonesians react so strongly. And I think there's you ask about what is it in the Indonesian psyche that comment made them so, it ticked them off so much. I think Indonesia is a developing country, and they were once ruled 350 years by the Dutch, and they always seem that, you know, they're from a south country, a developing country, and a lot of the white Anglo-Saxon countries are telling them what to do. And I think with this comment, the Indonesians, they feel like, no, this is just wrong. And it triggered an emotional reaction of pride. And that's why it became so much about the coins and about Tony Abbott's comments and not about the death penalty anymore. It's not about the issue of whether the death penalty is a right policy, but it's about, you know, they've offended the national sentiment.
I want to go back to the floor. I think some questions here in the audience. Yes, here in the front row.
I'm Jim Demings. Hi, Geraldine. I'm disappointed to learn that there are no Indonesian journalists in Canberra, because I remember a decade, 15 years ago, when the situation was different. There was one very spirited lady, Rati Harjono, and she was very active. She then went back into politics in Jakarta. But one of her things she did here was she wrote a book in English, I think it was published in Indonesian too, called The Poor White Tribe of Asia, which was a take on Lee Kuan Yew's comments about the white trash of Asia. But she was very spirited, and her editor, she was with Compass newspaper, her editor sent her to Mount Isa to do a report on the mail order brides in Mount Isa. But she filed totally the wrong story because she went and was able to tell the homes where the Filipino women were living because they had the tidiest gardens, the fence was always painted, the gates were not falling off, and these Filipino women were really tough, and they got the paycheck from the husband when he came home from work and doled out his drinking money and other things, and that was not the story that the editor wanted. But the Harjono family, they were quite well known. I spoke with Marty Nuttall-Lagar when he was here, and he knew them well. But that's a shame, though, that in Indonesia's eyes, that Canberra doesn't merit a little more attention, because it's certainly not reciprocated. Our interest there is much greater.
Yeah, there's certainly an imbalance there. I know Philippa Brandt in the back also had a comment or a question.
Thanks. It's been really interesting. I guess I have a more general question, and that's about the diversity and the vibrancy of the media in Indonesia, and I guess your reflections on how that compares with the Australian media scene. Also, whether the media scene in Indonesia tends to be regionally based, or is there an urban-rural divide? Just kind of your general thoughts on that. Thanks.
The media scene in Indonesia is incredible. There is so much going on. You have everything from online websites, which, as I explained, when you go to press conferences in Indonesia, it's always jam-packed, and half of the journalists are sitting on their BlackBerries doing this, just pushing out the lines, which go directly online. You know, and the competition is huge about who gets what and who's working for who. They shift, you know, they change jobs every 6 months, I think. It's constantly evolving. It's a very vibrant space. It's ultra competitive. You know, who gets the vision, who gets the story, and it's that's what makes it exciting, because it's a country in transition, a democracy, a growing democracy, and you have all this energy and this desire to tell the story, and there are so many stories to tell. So, you know, operating in that space was always fabulous and interesting. I personally, and I'm sure that my other colleagues, Michael, for instance, we had younger Indonesian journalists will come up to us and just say, you know, how would you tackle this story? How did you do that? What about this? So they're also curious to learn. They're very curious to learn, actually, aren't they? That they know that this is a craft that they have to get better at, and they want to know how to do it. So that was really lovely too. If you wanted to talk to a minister, you don't do it during a press conference, which is, in Australia, it's so nicely organised. You know, they come out and they talk at the podium and all the cameras are lined up neatly and everyone gets what they want. In Indonesia, it's, oh, yeah, you go to a press conference and we'll ask a question and we think, oh, that's that. But then it's the scrum afterwards where you get the real answers to what's really going on. Indonesians are very polite. They don't want to ask questions out loud, so they want to wait till they're really, like, this close and whisper it, ibu, ibu. And you're like, what'd she say? What'd she say? And your cameraman's got his arm up with the camera over and you've got the mic and you're trying to get under there, and, you know, that's how you get your story in Indonesia. It's also a place that, as I mentioned before, a lot of other media outlets are looking at more now. I'm sure I'm correct. You know, and you've got CNN setting up an Indonesia bureau. You've got who
CNN else? Indonesia, though. Is that the bureau? Yeah.
No, that's correct. Yeah. So, but they're looking at more. How do we tap in locally to what's going on in Indonesia? So it's very full on, but very different to here.
Partially, maybe that's the reason why we don't have any Indonesian journalists now in Canberra, because there are so many stories to tell in the country. Don't have that restriction anymore, not like 15 years ago.
If I could follow up on Philippa's question, one of the issues we talked about was media ownership in Indonesia, which is far more clearly politically aligned, if you can believe it, than in Australia. And so, for instance, Andini works for Metro TV, which is owned by Surya Palo, who is also the chairman or the patron, chief patron, of the National Democratic Party. And I say this only because Andini is known for being very vigorously independent and asking tough questions of both sides. But I think there are challenges in both countries in terms of media ownership and pressure from ownership to write a particular narrative or line. Maybe some of the Fairfax journalists here would dispute that. But I was wondering if I could ask you, Andini, to talk a little bit about that and the media landscape in Indonesia.
So we basically divided like the MSNBC and the Fox News. That is also happening in Indonesia. So people know which one to watch if you want to bash someone or you want to admire someone. For us, we're in a good position because Jokowi, we support Jokowi since the very beginning. Although now we're sort of like shifting, either we support Jokowi or we support the coalition that supports Jokowi. So because now they're in different sides. So it is kind of a challenging for the journalists, of course, and the producers to file news because we want to tell as it is, but we do have some limitation not to exploit much about the president or the administration. And but now, since we don't know which side are we supporting, the coalition party or the president, we can just tell it as it is. You know, we can make comments about the ministers and also about what Jokowi, he recently said that he didn't read what he signed. And that was like big news for us as well. So we can comment on that. And especially for my show, because it became a trending topic in social media, that line. So we have to talk about it. And the editorial was like, okay, go for it. Talk about it. But we as a journalist, we don't bash him, but we just tell it as it is. This is what's happening in public.
I mean, we talk about sort of political guidance from ownership in Indonesian media. But Lisa, you spoke earlier about being shocked back in August at the use of suppression orders in the Australian press. Was that you that mentioned that earlier? The story about SBY? Perhaps I'm getting it wrong. The use of court orders to... Michael, you...
Security issue.
Yeah. We're probably violating a court order right now by talking about it.
I was making the point that the Australian media scene, while it doesn't have quite the same ownership, the clear ownership biases that exist in the Indonesian media scene, there are many other restrictions, non-ownership related restrictions on what we can report. One is suppression orders in courts. There's hundreds of them at any given time, which restrict what we can report of court cases, including, and this one came up when a suppression order on the Securency case was in place in Australia, but SBY found out about it and started tweeting how outraged it was that he had been mentioned in this Australian court case on corruption, and that he most definitely was not corrupt, which gave us, the Indonesian correspondents, the license to report something that our Australian counterparts were not allowed to report. Some of the other restrictions include the very, very tight access now to politicians or government officials of any stripe in Australia. It's incredibly tightly controlled who you get access to and what questions get answered, whereas in Indonesia, really, you just have to camp outside their office, and if you've got enough patience, they'll eventually emerge and say something to you. And so it was very often, particularly during Operation Sovereign Borders, when the boats were being turned back, all the newsrooms in Australia were looking towards their Indonesia correspondents to find out what was going on, because the Australian government was saying nothing. And so I was getting daily or multiple daily calls saying, well, you know, has a boat been turned back? What can you... And I'd be, you know, heading off to try and find the orange lifeboat on the southern coast of Java and so on. So, you know, in some ways, there's a much greater freedom in Indonesia from compared to Australia. Also, I just wanted to answer your question about rural-urban divide. It's about 80% of the Indonesian media is based in Jakarta, and to some extent they show very little interest of what's going on outside Jakarta.
I think we'll take one more question from the floor and then we'd have to wrap up. Yes, Steve Grenville right there.
Thanks, Aaron. Steve Grenville from the Lowy Institute. One of the great puzzles I have is the difference between the way you see China reported in Australia and the way you see Indonesia reported in Australia. If you pick up the AFR, You'll find lots of stories on China. You open Business Spectator. They have maybe four or five stories every day on China. Now, is it that they're a big export market? Of course they are, but it's only iron ore and stuff like that. There aren't all that many Australians involved in China. Is it because China has more stories? Well, I look at all that reporting on the Politburo when the people who are reporting knew absolutely nothing and compared that with all the fascinating stories that would come out of Indonesian politics where you actually do know something. So why is it that China gets all this attention every day? Most of it, the same old stuff repeated again, China's slowing, China's corrupt and so on. There aren't any interesting stories from China compared with Indonesia. The Indonesian stories are much more interesting, more important to Australia, and yet Indonesia is here where China is like that.
I think one, we have a very biased audience here tonight in panel, so I think we'd all prefer more stories on Indonesia, but one person who's reported from both Northeast Asia and Southeast Asia is in the back of the room, and that's Greg Earl. I wonder, Greg, I'll just give you an opportunity to respond to that. You don't have to, but...
Well, actually, Stephen and I have had debates about this before, including online, after he's made comments about Australian journalists, so I don't mind continuing the debate now. But I think, well, just to answer your question about China, we have two correspondents in China, and we don't have a correspondent in Indonesia now. Sorry, so one reason we publish a lot of stories from China is we have someone there. So that's one reason. But, Stephen, I think you can't deny that that China has a much bigger impact on Australian financial markets now. Just the price of iron ore is driven by what happens in China. So I think you can't deny that China has a huge effect on the global economy and directly on the Australian economy, and much more than Indonesia. So that's the financial newspaper answer to the question. But I must say, inside my newspaper, and this is, telling stories out of school, I have lots of arguments with my colleagues who think that publishing a story from China basically means they've covered Asia for the week in say, the weekend newspaper. And, this is a common issue that I have, and I think it's driven partly by the fact that we have correspondents in China, but it's also driven by the idea that Asia is some sort of amorphous mass, and believe it or not, some people think that if you've covered one big country, that's Asia done, and you can turn back to Australia after that. Now, that debate is had, and sometimes I win and sometimes I lose, but... that's the measure of the fact that we don't have someone like Michael, or in our case at the Fin Review, to back up my low-level voice in the head office.
I think we've almost run out of time, but I want to give Andini the last word. I know you all have a tremendous responsibility in the media, and I think everyone who participated in the dialogue here today seems to really understand that and take that very seriously. And I think that's a positive sign for the relationship. And as my boss Michael Fullilove said earlier today, because the freedom of the press in Indonesia today, there is now nothing that can be said by an Australian journalist, as for example, in 1986 when David Jenkins was writing about Suharto's family, that has not already been said in the Indonesian press, and that's certainly a good thing for the relationship. But I wanted to give Andini just one last opportunity to comment on the role of the media in the relationship. Any final thoughts from either of you two?
I would say that I think that my takeaway from today's dialogue is that there's a need to put an emphasis on the relationship between the two countries, not only the relationship but also Australia as a country. Because as you said, that there's a lack of knowledge for Indonesians about Australia, other than this is the first world country and we are not the first world. And I think we need to change that perception, not only by the media, because I don't think that will be efficient enough, but through this type of talks, because I still have that, not mentality, but at least that way of thinking. That, we're not eye to eye, we're not apple to apple, Indonesia and Australia, unlike Indonesia and Malaysia, say, or Indonesia and Singapore. But I would like to see that we can sit together and speaking about an issue comfortably and without even have any perception of, oh, you are the emerging market and we are the first world country or whatever. And I think with the role of media is to have more discussions like this, even just in between the journalists or the editors. I think that's more substantial rather than doing a coverage in Australia about, you know, the death of Crocodile Dundee or whatever. I think it will make us a bit closer.
Helen?
I think there is actually a lot more space for collaboration, and there are a lot more similarities than what are acknowledged. You know, Geraldine Du talked about the growing middle class and the challenges they face, or the issues they're talking about. I'm just thinking about the times when you talk to Indonesian journalists when you're out on the road. You actually find there are quite a few things you have in common with them, or you have similar discussions to have. There doesn't seem to be, for some reason, kind of awareness of that or acknowledgement of that or an effort to find those things that we can be a bridge, perhaps. You know, and I don't think it's just the media's role to do that, but I certainly think there are definitely stories that we can connect with a lot more than what we do that isn't just the media's job. You know, it is to highlight, and sometimes there are clashes, but there is space for something else there. And it's why Michael went out and did the stories about Indonesia. It's why I went out and did the stories about Indonesia, because, like, this is interesting. This is just actually interesting, and I think people in Australia or somewhere else in the region would be interested in this.
Well, on that note, I think we'll have to conclude. Thank you for bearing with us in the relatively unconventional format for a Lowy Lecture Series event this evening. And we hope to see you at the next event. Thanks very much.